Sometime before he died in 1991, Graham Greene, who was a lifetime friend of the spy Kim Philby, suggested to me that it might be both enjoyable and profitable for me to go to Moscow to meet Philby's widow, Rufina, who might be willing to sell some of Philby's books and, indeed, all of the papers that he had accumulated during his Moscow years. The archive would be of considerable historical importance and provide the clearest indication possible of what Philby was doing between 1963, when he defected, up to his death in 1988. Kim Philby was the cleverest, the most important, and the most elusive of that set of spies. Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and Anthony Blunt were the others, who had been Cambridge undergraduates in the 1930s and subsequently worked for the Soviets. Though Philby had been rumbled and largely discredited by a series of inquiries into his behavior, he'd never been arrested, and he was working as a journalist in Beirut when a defector from the Soviets informed MI6, what they had suspected for some time, that Philby was indeed a Soviet agent. What happened next could only have come straight from a Carry On film, Carry On Spying. An agent was dispatched to Beirut to confront Philby with the facts and to bring him back to London. The ensuing conversation apparently went more or less like this. "We have you banged to rights," said the agent. "You come back to London, you bad spy." "Shan't," said Philby. "Would you come if I said please?" said the agent. "Certainly not," said Philby, firmly. And he commenced packing his bags and left for Russia the next day. Disconsolate at this rejection, the MI6 man returned to London, and by the time he arrived, Philby was already in Moscow, where he was soon to be reunited with Burgess and MacLean. But if MI6 didn't quite know how to handle Philby, neither did the KGB. He had been the source of some useful information, no doubt about that, but there was something even to the Soviets a little, how should I say it, a little untrustworthy about this urbane and unflappable Englishman. Could he be some sort of triple agent, after all? Philby protested his innocence, or perhaps I mean his guilt, but the KGB were unmoved. They set him up nicely with a good two-bedroom flat and a toothsome red-haired interpreter called Rufina, who later became his fourth wife, for Philby changed his sexual allegiances even more frequently than his national ones. And 10 years passed, slowly. A time that he spent reading and writing letters home, wandering round Red Square trying to find the latest cricket scores from English tourists, and occasionally in bed with Donald MacLean's wife, Melinda. But at last, at long last, the barriers came down, and Philby began to present his English seminars at the KGB. The purpose was to train Soviet agents how to pass when they were working in England, which involved a lot of astonishing nonsense about MCC ties and the rules of cricket, which accents to acquire and which clubs to join, and all of the arcana associated with a public school and an Oxbridge education. I met one of these students, let's call him Michael B., on my trip to Moscow in 1993 to examine Philby's library and papers. He was, he told me, acting as Mrs. Philby's agent in our negotiations. "How delightful to meet you," he said, shaking my hand. "I do so miss London. I had the most marvelous time there. Such a delightful city." "You worked in London?" I asked. "Oh, yes," he said suavely. "I was a TASS correspondent for 7 years. "Hold on a second," I said. "I'm sort of new to this. You were a student of Kim Philby's, and then you went to London." He nodded. "So you were a KGB spy?" "Of course," he said. He chortled. "Now, entrepreneur." In Michael's charming but vigilant company, Mrs. Philby and I began to go through Kim's library. He had thousands of volumes. He'd had plenty of time to read. And various friends, like Graham Greene, had been generous in sending him reading material. As I browsed, a few of the books virtually demanded a return to England. There was Kim's heavily annotated Handbook of Marxism from the 1930s, which was wonderful, and a couple of books from Guy Burgess's library were rather fun as well. But best of all was a copy of Peter Wright's Spycatcher, inscribed to the Philbys by Graham Greene. The inscription read, "For Kim and Rufina from Graham and Yvonne." That sounds homey enough, as if the book were a Christmas gift of some innocuous volume. Perhaps that's how Graham thought of it, but seen from the outside and after a few years, it was a remarkable find. A celebrated book about spying, presented by the finest writer about espionage to the third man himself. I had to have it. It was wonderful. Mrs. Philby had a distinct interest in money and was constantly anxious about inflation in post-communist Moscow. The fare on the palatial underground system had recently doubled to the equivalent of a penny a trip, and Rufina was in a stew about it. "But Rufina," I said, "you just sold one of Kim's unpublished essays to an English newspaper for £600.
"You do not understand Russians," she said wearily and fairly. "It is always a struggle here."
Perhaps you'd sell me a couple of books then," I asked. She would. During the afternoon, with both of us feeling a little carefree due to Michael's uncharacteristic absence, she and I did a deal, and I gave her £1,500 in cash, of which £1,000 was for the Spycatcher. Her eyes glowed. I considered making an offer on the one further book that I craved. I forget the title. It wasn't anything particular, but it bore a very warm inscription from Philby to MacLean's wife. "For Melinda, an orgasm a day keeps the doctor away. With love, from Kim." It is possible in my business to press your luck too far, and I regretfully put the book back on the shelf. Mrs. Philby was a tireless host, and during my 4 days in Moscow, she showed me round the local parks and churches and other places of interest. On several of these perambulations, it was impossible not to notice that we were being followed by a sauntering, portly, rather florid gentleman dressed in a cravat, spats, a bright waistcoat, and a houndstooth tweed jacket, as if in a P.G. Woodhouse novel. He didn't look local. He made no attempt to conceal himself. How could he? Rather the reverse. He wanted me to know that he was there. It was the man from Sotheby's. It's no wonder he was on the chase. The Philby papers were wonderful, terrific. There were all of the notebooks containing his English seminar material, an unfinished draft of an autobiography, documentation concerning his status at the KGB, letters from various important Russian and English figures, diaries, unpublished articles. And there were also a number of kitsch plastic trophies, you know, the sort your kids get for the under-12s football leagues, which had been awarded to Comrade Philby by the KGB. He must have scored a lot of goals. Considered together, the material provided a wonderfully clear and hitherto entirely unknown picture of Philby's years in Moscow. Rufina, Michael, and I agreed that I could offer the archive to the British Library at a price of £60,000. Her eyes were wet with anticipation. Michael looked distinctly pleased. The British Library were keen, but they needed governmental approval before they could proceed with such a potentially controversial acquisition. Shortly after the proposal was sent by them to the Foreign Office, though, I received a phone call from Moscow. It was Michael.
"Rick," he said, in a tone lacking his customary charm, "we are not happy."
All of a sudden he had a Russian accent. "What's the matter, Michael?" I said. "Do tell me."
"Those books you have purchased from Rufina, I do not like the price you have put on them."
This was genuinely astonishing. I'd put the books on a shelf behind my desk, having jotted a notional price in each of them because I wasn't yet ready to part with any of them. And they added up to £5,000, with the Spycatcher, of course, the most expensive of the lot. No one, other than myself and my working colleagues, had seen them. At night, we closed the shop, and an extremely efficient burglar alarm is set.
Those are not prices. I said they're like insurance valuations. Anyway, how do you know?
Never mind, he said. I have lost confidence in you.
Listen, Michael, I said, unsure where this was going. I flew to Moscow. I spent 4 nights in a hotel. I gave Rufina a free and detailed appraisal of the books and the papers in the library. I spent hundreds of pounds entertaining you both, and I need to make some profit. That is called capitalism, and it's how my wife and children come to eat.
We do not understand this, he said. We are just simple Russians.
Simple Russians? Simple Russians? You've got to be kidding, I said. You're sort of big shot in the KGB, and I'm just a simple bookseller.
The deal is off, he said, and he put the phone down.
At the British Library Department of Manuscripts, the unfailingly genial archivist who had painstakingly negotiated the purchase was distinctly unhappy with me.
It's obvious, you stupid boy, he said testily. Did you offer him a bribe?
It was by now abundantly clear that I was out of my depth, as if I'd wandered into the script of a Graham Greene fantasy without being taught my lines. My instructions were to bribe an ex-KGB agent on behalf of the British Library so that the Foreign Office-sanctioned purchase of a traitor's papers could be concluded. Okay, I get that. I rang Michael back in Moscow, who didn't sound very pleased to hear from me. Michael, I said, in a tone both casual and insinuating, I'm calling to apologize. I've been so tied up with the purchase and details of this archive that I neglected to mention your introductory commission.
Silence.
In such cases, it's customary in my trade to pay the seller's agent a fee of 10% of the price. That would come to £6,000 to you. You can have it in cash if you want.
Are you trying to bribe me? He asked, sounding genuinely shocked.
Yes, I said. Is it working? He hung up the phone. Maybe the man from Sotheby's paid him more. Who knows? Perhaps Michael simply did it for the love of his old mentor or of his younger wife. When the Philby material came up at Sotheby's London in August of 1994, Rufina had taken the decision to split up the archive into its constituent parts, presumably to increase the take, though the final sales figures achieved more or less what the British Library would have paid in the first place. But the individual items were purchased by a wide variety of buyers, most of them unidentified, and Kim Philby's papers were distributed in bits round the world. Anyone now wishing to do research on Philby's Moscow years would have to search desperately and sometimes fruitlessly to reassemble the papers. There must have been something I could have done. Maybe I shouldn't have bought the 4 books that caused the problem. If I hadn't, the deal might have gone through. But after all, I am a book dealer, and Mrs. Philby was happy to take the cash. Maybe I shouldn't have written the prices in them, but why not? They're in my office, and they represented a fair profit after expenses. And I don't think I can be faulted for failure to anticipate an infiltration of KGB agents with X-ray eyes into my office. Or perhaps after my phone call from Michael, I should have caught the night flight to Moscow. My pockets stuffed with cash. At least in person, I could have put the case, not for my sake, not for theirs, but for the integrity of the archive, because after all, it is through such combinations of pieces of paper that a society defines and records itself, and it is in our libraries that such paper is best protected, made available, and studied. I eventually sold the inscribed spycatcher to my literary agent, the late Giles Gordon, who had acted as Peter Wright's agent in the original sale of the manuscript to its publishers. And the book almost immediately joined the relatively short list of books that I've always regretted selling, not like the inscribed first editions of Ulysses or The Wasteland, because it had overweening literary importance, certainly not, but because of what it reminded me of Graham Greene and Rufina Philby and Michael B.,
my trip to Moscow, Sotheby's, the British Library, and the loss of the Philby Archive. I miss that book dreadfully. I'd like to have it with me, indeed have it mounted on a plinth on my desk as John Donne had his human skull, a bibliographic memento mori. I like the thought that it would puzzle others to see such an indifferent book so curiously elevated. But I would know what it signified, and after all, you don't have to admire a book to be changed by it.